This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Witness X, written by Mark Dawson with Scott Mariani, performed by David Thorpe. Highgate. Chapter 1. Tamsin Bell looked anxiously at her watch, worried about getting to work on time. She'd taken the job of assistant manager at an upmarket West End art gallery just 2 months earlier and was eager to please her new boss. Sebastian Faulkner would certainly not be impressed when she rolled in 20 minutes late for the third time that month. Tamsin was pulling on her cashmere coat as she hurried down the front steps of the large, imposing and very expensive red-brick Victorian house into which she and her husband Tony had moved earlier that year. A significant upsize from the modest apartment they'd occupied since getting married. The front garden was strewn with autumn leaves, and more were spiring down from the mature oak trees covering the patch left bare by Tony's Jaguar earlier that morning. Tamsin buttoned up her coat, feeling the bite of chill in the air that the brisk walk to Highgate Tube Station would soon warm away. The fact was that Tamsin didn't need to work, and only did so for pleasure, even though she'd learned early on that Seb Faulkner could be difficult in his ways. She could quit tomorrow and spend her days riding horses, reading, painting, pruning roses, whatever she wanted. Tony earned a good deal of money doing what he did for Rush Laboratories in Epping Forest, though quite what that was he never really spoke about in detail, and she never really probed. Until the future day when children came into their life, a subject that had been discussed but never so far gone beyond the tentative planning stage, Tamsin was a free agent. She was still only 29. Children could wait. As she hurried on her way, the autumnal breeze catching her long blonde hair, she was oblivious of the admiring glances coming her way from a couple of young guys sitting sipping lattes at a pavement cafe. Tamsin Bell, nay Tamsin Gordon, had never considered herself a great beauty, though the rest of the world would beg to differ. Her looks were occasionally responsible for stopping traffic, but of course she was too unself-conscious to pay the least bit of attention. Tamsin was walking down the narrow, leafy approach to the tube station when she heard someone call her name. She glanced around to see who, but none of the commuters were acknowledging her, apart from the usual coy stares and smiles from single men. Then she heard it again.
Tamsin!
She'd never seen the man before. He was crossing the street diagonally towards her, signalling. How did he know her name? More strange, he was wearing a motorcycle helmet with the visor up. The helmet was black, like his leather jacket and jeans. What little of his face the helmet didn't hide was obscured by wraparound sunglasses. A sports motorcycle was pulled up at the opposite curb, its driver similarly dressed in black, his helmet visor flipped right down to shield his face. He was hunched down low across the tank, one foot on the road and the other on its peg, blipping the bike's throttle with jerky little twists of his right wrist.
"I'm sorry. Do I know you?"
Tamsin said to the man approaching her. She kept her voice pleasant enough, but she frowned as she struggled to recognize him. He was not a big man, lean and light on his feet, probably no more than 5'6" in height. His complexion, what she could see of it, definitely had a light brown luster. A customer of the gallery, perhaps. She wished he would at least remove his helmet. It unsettled her a little, like someone wearing a mask. As he walked closer, she noticed the object he was carrying in his gloved hand. It looked like a beaker of something, a clear, colourless liquid that appeared too viscous to be water. What was he doing? Tamsin's body began to stiffen, as she sensed that something wasn't right about the situation. Her instinct was suddenly telling her to back off, right off, get out of here now. But Tamsin's self-preservation instinct was too slow. and her reaction was delayed by a crucial couple of seconds. 2 seconds that were about to permanently alter the course of her life. The stranger said,
"Hey, Tamsin, have a drink."
And before she could duck out of the way or even flinch, he dashed the contents of the beaker in her face. She gasped, first in shock and surprise, then in unspeakable horror, as she felt the terrible burning sensation spread all over her face like nothing she had ever felt before. Her vision was suddenly all blurry, and breathing was difficult. She could smell something awful like scorched feathers. She fell to her knees and pressed her hands to her face. The agony was so intense that she couldn't even scream. That was when she looked down at her fingers with the one eye that could still see, and realized that the flesh of her face was coming away like melted wax in her hands. Which was the last thing Tamsin would remember before waking up in the hospital some hours later, after the first of many operations to save her from the ravages of the acid. With a last impassive look at his victim as she lay writhing on the ground, the attacker sprinted nimbly back to the waiting motorcycle and leaped astride the pillion, yelling to the rider in a language that none of the immediate witnesses to the incident happened to understand. The rider snapped the machine into gear and tore open the throttle, and the bike took off with a howling roar from its twin exhausts and its front wheels skipping off the road. It accelerated wildly up the street, punched into the traffic, and was gone forever. The attack had been swift and efficient and was over in moments, but for Tamsin Bell, the nightmare was just beginning. Chapter 2. Things moved quickly after that. 2 paramedic teams were dispatched in fast response cars and attended to the victim, who was airlifted to the Royal Free Hospital in Hampstead shortly afterwards by a London Air Ambulance helicopter. Meanwhile, the police were working at full throttle to seal off the crime scene and quiz potential witnesses. They soon singled out 2 key candidates, Rashid Hakimi, who was 58, and Stephen Brooks, who was 34. The 2 men had each made a 999 call moments after the nightmare happened. In separate statements, Hakimi and Brooks gave almost identical descriptions of the attacker, his accomplice, and the getaway vehicle, which was described as a large black and green sports bike. The witnesses' reports concurred that the helmets both men were wearing would make identification of the pillion passenger very difficult, and the rider impossible, as his visor had remained closed the entire time. However, while Hakimi had been too far away to hear, Brooks offered the vital information that the attacker had called the victim's name at least once, possibly twice, before assaulting her. This seemed to confirm that the attack had not been a random incident, but a targeted strike, as most such crimes were. Brooks also reported that the attacker spoke with a particular accent that he described as Chinglish, although that pejorative expression wasn't used on his statement. Instead, it was cautiously worded to read that the alleged perpetrator sounded as if he might have been of possible Far Eastern ethnic origin. Meanwhile, footage from CCTV cameras was scrutinised. It revealed the route that the getaway motorcycle had taken from Highgate Tube Station. Tamsin Bell's 2 assailants had dumped the bike less than a mile away and hopped into a waiting van. Police soon recovered the bike, a Kawasaki ZZR 1400 reported stolen across town earlier that morning. It had been torched and was found totally clean of fingerprints other than its owner's. The plain white VW Transporter panel van had been fitted with false number plates, and its location was still unknown. Somewhat more promisingly, specialist technicians had managed to isolate 0.5 seconds worth of camera footage in which the rider and his pillion passenger removed their helmets as they clambered inside the transporter. They were already hard at work on enhancing the video image frame by frame in the hope that it might offer a positive ID of either man. It was a long shot, and expectations were not high. During this time, a very distraught Tony Bell was called away from his office at Rush Laboratories, a private science facility where he'd served for the last 8 years as a technical coordinator and project manager. Having been informed by police of the nature and severity of the attack on his wife Tamsin, he demanded to see her. That wasn't possible, they said, because she had already been hurried into surgery. Under sedation for shock, he was then interviewed by officers of Scotland Yard. He professed to have absolutely no idea why anyone would have targeted his wife like this. No, neither he nor she had any particular friends or acquaintances of Chinese, Japanese, or other Far Eastern ethnicity. No, they were not in any kind of trouble. Why would they be? They were a happily married, middle-class, financially comfortable, debt-free and law-abiding couple, as far from trouble as it was possible to get. And no, emphatically no, Tamsin was not romantically involved with anyone else. This was not a malicious act of revenge by some thwarted lover or anything like it, and Bell passionately refuted and resented the very idea. This was, he insisted, simply a cruel and monstrous act against an innocent victim. While all this was going on, the surgeons were battling desperately to repair their badly ravaged patient. The first major issue to deal with had been the threat of cardiac arrest resulting from the systemic toxicity brought on by the acid her assailant had used against her. Once they'd succeeded in averting that danger, their second concern was the damage to the respiratory tract caused by the involuntary inhalation of acid vapours. It would take a lot of effort to get her breathing normally again. Next on their list of urgent priorities was rescuing the left eye, which was at this point welded shut by a mess of fused tissues. Only further investigation would tell whether anything was left of the eyeball inside. And there would be a lot more work after that. Lips, nose, ears, cheek, chin, throat, all had taken a direct hit from the acid. This was what was euphemistically termed a life-altering trauma. Even if they performed miracles, the surgeon's prognosis was that the beautiful young woman would be severely disfigured for life. They had a hell of a long day ahead of them. Vauxhall Cross. Chapter 3. Far away across London, on an upper floor deep inside the confines of an anonymous-looking grey block of a building overlooking the Thames, the new case file landed on the desk of a man whom his colleagues, including most of his superiors, as well as the army of personnel he commanded, knew only as Control. The world to which he belonged was fond of anonymous titles. Control was the supreme ruler of the closeted little kingdom of Group 15, a subdivision of an organisation that was dubbed The Firm. The functions and operations that the group performed were virtually unknown to the outside, and for very good reason. Control had been enjoying a rare coffee break at his desk, when the hurriedly assembled case file came through, marked top priority. He flipped open the folder and addressed its contents with his customary look of severity, which grew graver as he read down the page. When he had finished, he closed the file and leaned back in his plush leather desk chair. He ruminated for a few moments, then reached for the phone. His aide-de-camp, an ex-soldier called Tanner, came into his room. "Sir?" Control replied in a flat, expressionless voice, "Get me number 12. Sierra de los Filabres. Chapter 4. High in the Sierra, another day was slowly drawing to a close. The daytime hours were still warm, even as autumn crept closer, but a far cry from the brutal heat of summer. Brian Duffy had been here for most of the season. He could take the heat. He'd taken Iraq in July. Later, as he did every evening, Duffy would take a moment to stand atop a high rock and watch as the sun sank behind the mountains, turning their blue ridges to the colour of blood. The nights were getting chillier. Brian Duffy could take the cold as well. He'd seen Afghanistan in January. This was nothing. Duffy was sitting on a sun lounger that overlooked the pool. His guitar was across his lap, his head bent low over the instrument, his hands aching from hours of playing. The pulsing, heady music was as much part of this savage and feral landscape as the mountains and the rivers. To feel its sounds and rhythms throbbing through you was to be one with the place. When Duffy played, he felt himself disappear. That was why he loved it so much. Flamenco guitar was one of the most difficult and challenging musical arts to master. Because it evolved largely out of the long rule of the Moors over Spain, its Arabic rhythms were alien to the traditional Western ear. The Spanish gypsies here had it in their blood. Duffy had found a tutor in one of the bars he visited in Zahara de la Sierra. The music seemed to flow effortlessly from the man, but then he had devoted his life to the near impossible physical techniques that a flamenco player must learn. Duffy was a white boy from Croydon and at a natural disadvantage. But then, life had never been easy for Duffy. He was used to that. He had never retreated from a challenge in all his 33 years, and he wasn't about to shrink away from this one either. Never back down. That credo had brought him as much bad luck and trouble in his time as it had good things. But that was who he was. He was going to learn how to play. He would play until his fingertips dropped off. Then he'd go on playing with the bony stumps. He had been like that when he had initially been told he wasn't right for the army. The sergeant on the range who had taught him to shoot had said the same thing. Duffy had proved them wrong. He was competitive, and he hated failure. And he had had to find something to do during his unwanted and enforced leave of absence from everything he knew in London. He continued for another hour until it was too dark to play, and then he packed up his guitar and placed it among the scant possessions that he carried in the back of his beat-up old Jeep. 2 kilometres down the mountainside, the speckled lights of the little mountain village glowed faintly. There was a little taverna down there, off the pretty little village plaza, which Duffy had visited a few times and would visit again tonight. He climbed into his Jeep and made his way down the twisting, rocky road. Chapter 5. Zahara de la Sierra was a pueblo blanco, one of the white towns that gathered on the flanks of the mountains in the Sierra de Grazalema. The villages were characterized by the whitewashed walls and red and brown tiled roofs of the buildings. Duffy found that the men and women who lived here were deeply traditional, with a natural distrust for outsiders. It had taken Duffy several weeks to feel as if he was, if not quite accepted, then at least tolerated within the village. The length of his stay had made it obvious that he was more than a tourist, and his fluent Spanish had done much to endear him. He walked into Cerveceria El Gallo, his favourite taverna. It was a Saturday night, and the old stone-built barroom was quiet and half-empty. His kind of place. Far away from the troubles of the world. "Una cerveza, por favor," he said to the barman, spilt some cash on the bar, and carried his beer to a table at the far end of the room. He sat with his back to the wall, positioned so as to be able to see both the door and the windows. Old habits never die. He sipped his beer, flexed his tired fingers, and sat quietly, listening to the music in his head. But his watchful eyes missed nothing. Like the other stranger in the village, for instance. Through the window, Duffy saw him get out of a black Mercedes SUV and cross the plaza. Moments later, the stranger entered the taverna. The man was clearly not a local. He was dressed in a light suit, a little travel-wrinkled and dusty. He was obviously ex-military, and he walked with a limp. Duffy knew why. A convoy that the man had been travelling within had been hit by an IED on the road out of Kabul, and he had lost his right leg below the knee. His name was Captain David Tanner, and he was the private secretary for the man in London who had banished him to Spain. Tanner seemed to be looking for someone, and Duffy had a feeling who that might be. He had been expecting it. Tanner spotted Duffy, smiled, and ambled casually up to his table. The man pointed at the empty chairs.
"Do you mind if I sit down?"
Duffy said nothing. He was not one to waste words. He motioned, just a slight downward inclination of the head to say, "I'm not stopping you." Tanner sat, first pausing to hike up the seams of his creased trouser legs. He glanced around him, as though to check nobody would eavesdrop on what he was about to say. As though anyone in this bar would give a damn what two white strangers had to say to one another, Duffy thought. He found, despite the air of nonchalance that he tried to project, that he was nervous. He had been waiting for contact to be made for months, and here it was. At last. He said nothing and sat very, very still. Tanner said,
"You're not an easy fellow to track down."
Duffy spoke at last, softly, slowly.
"Have I decided?" "Not exactly. But there has been a development. And you've been in exile a long time, Duffy. Too long. I've been sent to fetch you home."
Malaga. Chapter 6. Tanner had flown out to Spain aboard one of the RAF's BAE-125 jets. It was a twin jet, most often used to transfer government officials and military brass around the world. The cabin was configured to carry 6 passengers, but as it rumbled down the runway to commence its return flight, there were only Tanner and Duffy aboard. Duffy had tried to engage Tanner in conversation during the drive from the mountains to the airport. The older man had been happy to chat about inconsequential things, but when Duffy moved the conversation onto the legal case, or the reason for his abrupt summons back to London, he quickly changed the subject. Duffy took the hint. Whatever the reason for his recall, Tanner had been given strict orders not to discuss it. The plane reached the top of its climb and levelled out. Duffy undid his belt and moved forward. There was a refrigerator at the front of the cabin, and Duffy helped himself to a bottle of Peroni. He took the beer back to his seat and gazed out of the window as the moon climbed into the sky, burnishing the mountain ranges with its silvered light. The suggestion that it was time to return was not a request. It was an order, even though Tanner was too polite to couch it in those terms. Duffy had not needed to be persuaded. He had been itching to return for months. Duffy allowed his mind to wander. It was obvious that something had happened in the proceedings that were being brought against him, and he found his thoughts drifting back to the events of 2 years earlier. They were never far from his mind. His resentment at what had been allowed to happen to him brought them back again and again, an itch that he couldn't scratch. Duffy had been sent to capture an Egyptian national who had passed over the Pakistani border. The man, Mohammed Mahfouz, was reputed to have been involved in an aborted bombing campaign in London and was reported to be heading into the Hindu Kush, where the Taliban would make him disappear. Duffy intercepted him outside Karachi and renditioned him to a CIA black site in Morocco, and then, ultimately, to Guantanamo. Mahfouz's family had engaged a lawyer from a human rights charity and, after a highly public campaign, Mahfouz was released and returned home, where he immediately brought a case against the government. He alleged that a British agent, identified only as Witness X, had kidnapped him and then participated in his interrogation in Morocco. The questioning, it was alleged, was illegal and included methods that were prohibited under the Geneva Convention. Duffy had found the entire process to be a farce. He knew that Marfouz was guilty. During a protracted session of interrogation, as he gasped for breath after Duffy had removed the sodden rag from his mouth, he had admitted to being involved in a plot to bomb Oxford Street during the Christmas rush. But none of that mattered. Marfouz's lawyer was brilliant, and the evidence against his client had all been dismissed as unreliable due to the method of its procurement. The left-wing press had rallied to Marfouz's case, with leaders written that a British national, innocent of all crimes, had been tortured by his own government. The government demanded that the agent involved be suspended, and control had said that his hands were tied. He had stood Duffy down, on full pay, and insisted that he take an extended holiday. Duffy's parents had a holiday home in Sierra de los Filabres, and he had gone there, staying out of the limelight until the affair died down. But that had not happened yet. The papers were still full of the charade as the court case wound interminably on. Duffy had resigned himself to a long wait, with no guarantees about what would happen to him at the end of it. Control had guaranteed that he would not be named, and that the government would quash the proceedings, but the longer the case had dragged on, the less Duffy had believed it. What if Marfouz's case had acquired so much momentum that it was impossible to stop?
"We'll be there in 2.5 hours, Tanner said.
"Where are we going?"
"The Cross," Tanner replied. "The boss wants to see you tonight."
Vauxhall Cross. Chapter 7. 5 hours later. The building was the same old familiar grey block on the edge of the river. It was dark. It was cold. It was hammering down with rain. It was just how it was the last time Duffy had been here. Tanner led him through the corridors of the building, walking a few steps ahead. Duffy glanced at his watch. 11:55 on a Sunday morning. Well, well, someone was certainly working overtime. These little early morning gatherings of the firm didn't happen without reason. Not for the first time, Duffy wondered why he was suddenly being whisked back to base like this. It wasn't because they'd missed the pleasure of his company, that was for sure. On the other side of the gleaming cherry wood doorway, two more armed guards flanked the interior. Tanner ushered Duffy through into the large conference room, which was dominated by a long, shiny table surrounded by padded chairs. Screens on the walls, no windows. Dim lighting around the edges of the room, strong halogens illuminating the table at its centre. Nothing had changed. Duffy had attended more of these powwows than he cared to count. Several people were already seated and waiting around the conference table. There were a few unfamiliar faces, but Duffy recognised some others. In his late 50s, grey hair, his 6-foot frame folded uncomfortably into his chair, Sir Benjamin Stone was the current head of the Secret Intelligence Service. Some years older, at just the wrong side of 60, but still something of an eye-catcher, Eliza Cheatham was unquestionably the most glamorous Director General the Secret Service had ever appointed, and possibly the most ruthless too. Then, opposite her, was the unmistakable figure of Vivian Bloom, also known as the Reverend, an antiquated senior civil servant and Cold War veteran who never seemed to tire of his duties as point man between the firm and Her Majesty's government. While his colleagues were all smartly turned out despite the late hour, Bloom had long ago ceased to care about his personal appearance. He wore a baggy suit that looked as though he had been sleeping in it for a week. His thick glasses were so greasy it was a wonder he could see out of them. The eternal pipe was stuck in one crinkled corner of his mouth, puffing clouds of cheap tobacco. Duffy didn't doubt that some poor gopher would have had the job of deactivating all the smoke alarms. The last person Duffy recognised of those seated at the table was his direct superior, the man he answered to above all others in the firm, and known only as Control. He was sitting quietly, watching Duffy with a stony, penetrating gaze. The doors closed. Evidently Duffy was the last to arrive. He approached the table and sat down, then leaned back and surveyed the assembly with a wary eye. Something must be up for sure, for them to scramble together such a collection of top brass in the dead of night. It had to be a national emergency, or close to it. It was the comely yet deadly Cheetham who opened the meeting with an acerbic, "Welcome back, Number 12. Been spending your enforced vacation well, I trust?"
"Learning the guitar," Duffy said.
She gave him a smile that would terrify a rattlesnake.
"Really?"
she said.
"You don't strike me as the musical type."
Duffy managed a thin smile of his own.
"I assume there's been progress in the case?"
"There's been a little movement from the Attorney General," she replied.
"A little movement? What does that mean, Mum?"
"We're hoping that Mr. Marfouz can be persuaded to take an offer."
"That's it. I was hoping for something more than that."
She shook her head and smiled again. "I'm afraid the situation you found yourself in has become rather more delicate over the last few weeks. Have you read the papers?"
"I've been avoiding them."
She nodded as if that was perfectly understandable. "The lawyers for the dead man have been pressing for a formal investigation, as you know."
"Yes," Duffy said, interrupting her. "And I was promised that wouldn't happen."
"Quite," she replied. "And it is still our position that that cannot happen. National security does not need the spectacle of a judge going through our dirty laundry." Dirty laundry. Cheetham always chose her words carefully, and the implication there of fault, of culpability, was impossible to miss. "But," Duffy pressed,
"there's been a leak. From the American side, not ours. Someone got hold of the recording of the interrogation. It's been passed to the press, and they've been threatening to release it. We have issued a D notice to suppress it, but I'm not confident it'll hold."
"I'm on the tape."
"Your voice. It's audio only, thankfully, but it's obvious that Marfouz was being questioned by a man with a South London accent, and not just the CIA.
Duffy sighed disconsolately. "This was supposed to have been wrapped up," he said. "It shouldn't have taken so long, and now this... If there's an inquest, and this is introduced..."
"There's not going to be an inquest," Stone said quickly. "Can you guarantee that, sir?"
He glanced away for a second, long enough.
"I can't," he said. "But you have my word that we are doing everything we can to..."
Duffy cursed under his breath. He couldn't help it. But everyone around the table heard it, and Stone stopped before he could finish what Duffy knew would be another worthy, but ultimately unsatisfactory, protestation that Duffy had the full support of the service. There was a moment of awkward silence.
I'm sorry, sir," Duffy said. "I don't mean to sound ungrateful, but I've been hiding in the mountains for 3 months, and if I might speak frankly, I'm bored out of my mind. I want to get back to work."
Bloom fixed a stern look at Duffy.
"Then you'll be pleased that we have some work for you."
"Sir?"
He plucked his pipe stem out of his mouth, and a thin stream of smoke caught the lights as he waved it in the direction of Control.
"Control insists that you're the right man for this assignment. Personally, I am far from convinced."
Duffy had to fight down the eager, "What assignment?" But he held back. He'd find out soon enough, and he would look like a callow new recruit if he betrayed his enthusiasm. Bloom produced a thick file and tapped it with his pipe stem, which doubled as a pointer.
As it's my task to oversee and approve the activities of Group 15 from the government's point of view, I have been reviewing your record, Number 12. To say it is patchy would be a gross understatement. Your 6 years with the Marines were marked by more punishments and demotions than any other 10 men combined. If not for your exemplary combat skills, extremely high levels of fitness and stamina and coolness under fire, and I'm just reading what it says here, at any rate, they'd have dropped you faster than a hot coal. You're a live wire.
Duffy shrugged. He'd heard it all before 1,000 times over. Bloom hadn't finished his summary of Duffy's record.
So, you had 6 years as a commando, then applied to the special boat service.
He paused and shook his head, unable to prevent the corners of his mouth twitching up in amusement.
Which you only did as a bet.
Duffy cut in. To prove that I could.
And for which you were rejected.
Control tapped his fingers against the table.
Yet he was top of his selection class for endurance and weapons proficiency. But bottom for discipline and attitude control. I understand why you'd need to back your man. You selected him for the group, but he is not a team player.
Control shrugged.
I don't need team players. Too independent-minded. Virtually unable to receive orders from a commanding officer while keeping his mouth shut and his own opinions to himself.
I have a short fuse, Duffy admitted.
And a big mouth.
That's been said before. I'm trying to be better. Bloom ignored the assurance. He closed the file as if he had seen enough.
Shortly after being RTU'd, you were recruited to Group 15. Though exactly how and why are still a mystery to me.
It was Control who came to the rescue.
I thought we had already concluded the discussion, Vivian. Whatever the SBS might have decided, I felt that his exceptional skills singled him out as of interest as a potential group asset.
Thanks, Chief. Duffy's recruitment earlier had come as a surprise to him, too. Prior to that, like virtually everyone else, he had had no knowledge of the group's existence. It had been the chance of working alone that had attracted him to the job. Control had sold it to him like that. Group 15 agents operated singly, in the shadows, depending on their own wits and resources. It had been the perfect opportunity for him.
We took a chance,
Control finished.
One that I believe was warranted. Until 6 months ago.
Duffy had heard enough. I'm sorry, he said, fighting to maintain his manners in the face of what was looking like deliberately spiteful provocation. I came back here tonight because I was led to believe that the case against me was coming to an end. That ain't true. You talk about an assignment instead, but now you seem intent on questioning my suitability for work I have proved myself worthy of 10 times over. He stood up. If I might be excused, sirs and madam, I'll go back to Spain until you have better news for me.
Like you said, Bloom said, a big mouth.
Control raised a hand, a warning perhaps for him to shut his mouth. I'm sorry, Duffy said again. Bloom gave a dark, mirthless chuckle.
Come on, Number 12. You can't just walk away, you know that. Once you're in, you're in. And whatever my many reservations about your work, Control still has faith.
And we do have a job for you, Cheatham said. We don't just think you're the best man for the job. Under the circumstances, in fact, you're the only man for the job. Chapter 8. Duffy was confused by what Cheatham had just said, but when she told him to sit, he did as he was told. He looked at the others around the table. Bloom pursed his lips and glanced across at Sir Benjamin Stone. The head of SIS nodded.
Show him.
Control slipped a hand down to a hidden console beneath the table, and one of the large wall screens flashed up a vivid, high-definition image. It wasn't a satellite feed of a hidden terrorist base in the hills of Pakistan, nor was it a war-ravaged landscape somewhere in the Middle East. It was an image of a woman's face, or what was left of it. Duffy gazed at the screen without a reaction. Most people would have turned their heads away or vomited. Cheetham averted her eyes with a muttered, "Christ."
"Tell us what you see, Number 12,"
Control said. "I see a picture of a woman with her face burnt off," Duffy replied.
"Any thoughts on what might have done this kind of damage?"
Duffy glanced again at the picture. Only the styling and length of the victim's blonde hair offered any clue as to her sex. The face itself was almost entirely a mass of burned raw meat. One eye was completely gone, the other swollen shut and liable to go the same way unless seen to by a very skilled surgeon. The lips were burned off, exposing the teeth. One cheek had been so badly marred that it was melted right through, exposing the inside of the mouth. The chin was a glob of tissue fused with the jaw and throat. The overall sickening effect was of a waxwork that had been worked over with a blowtorch. Only this was a real living person, one who was now going to have to live in seclusion for the rest of her days.
"Phosphorus grenade would do it. Napalm, except we apparently don't use it anymore. But I'm betting on acid, sulfuric or hydrochloric. Either would produce these results, and you can buy them cheap in any hardware shop. Am I to assume this happened here in Britain? Disfiguring people seems to become a national pastime lately."
"Correct on both counts," Bloom said. "This was a sulfuric acid attack, and it took place here in London only a few days ago."
Bloom nodded to Control. Control pressed another button, and a second photo appeared to the right of the first. A woman's face cropped from what appeared to be a wedding or party photo. Duffy stared at the second screen, and all the air seemed to have been sucked out of the conference room as the dark almond eyes of the woman in the photo gazed back at him. She was smiling and looked happy and bright and all that she once had been. Until now. With a lurch in the pit of his stomach, he realized that it was the same woman on both screens. He found his self-control deserting him, and he had to restrain the urge to scream at Control, at Stone, at Bloom, at the lot of them. Instead of that, he said in a voice that was tight and thrumming with menace, "This is some kind of joke." But it wasn't. The woman in the picture was Tamsin. His Tamsin. 4 years earlier. Chapter 9. Duffy had owned the Audi TT Sport convertible for just under a week, purchased the same day he'd returned from his latest pleasure tour of Afghanistan with the Royal Marines. He was still exploring the car's performance limits as he buzzed through the Kent countryside like a fighter pilot, top down, totally in control, senses focused on every nuance of the road ahead. The engine notes soared as he downshifted at 90 for the upcoming bend. The instrument needles dipped and then started quickly climbing again as he accelerated hard out of the turn. The brown and white blur of a moving object bursting from the roadside bushes, cutting across his path, made him slam on the brakes. He brought the Audi to a rapid, controlled halt as a young boxer dog pranced about in the middle of the road, still trailing a leather lead from his collar. Most drivers would have run straight into the mutt, but Duffy's reflexes were honed to a razor edge. Even as the Audi came to a halt, Duffy could see a white van coming fast the other way, giving no indication of slowing down. He leaped from the car and went sprinting towards the dog, who seemed as oblivious of the oncoming vehicle as its driver apparently was of the animal's presence in the road. By the time the van's brakes began to screech, it was almost too late. Duffy made it to the dog with half a second to spare, snatched him up in his arms and yanked him out of the van's path as its wheels locked solid and it began to veer wildly across the road, smashing into Duffy's parked Audi. Duffy might have had something to say about that, but he didn't get the chance. To the sound of howling rubber, another car came speeding around the bend behind him, braked and skidded to avoid the wreck of the white van and the Audi, and, with nowhere else to go, careened straight towards him. Duffy barely had time to register the imminent impact. With all his strength, he threw the dog bodily towards the verge. In the next instant, a shocking impact spun him off his feet and swept him up over the bonnet of the oncoming car. He hit the windscreen with his left shoulder and was thrown over the roof. For a weird moment, he was weightless, floating in midair as though in a dream. Then, the road came up to meet him, and everything went black. Duffy awoke to a confused jumble of flashing blue lights and bustle and voices all around him. He realized he was lying on a gurney with an ambulance crew milling and fussing over him. It was a second or two before the sensation of pain cut in, jolting through his body like a couple of million volts. Not as bad as getting your entrails hacked out by machete-wielding Taliban fighters, as had happened to a mate of his, but still pretty uncomfortable. The dislocated shoulder was one thing. The broken left femur was going to be a bitch to heal. Duffy had to laugh. Months spent in a bloody war zone, dodging bullets, mortar fire and suicide bombers without a scratch, and now this. What a great way to spend your leave, hobbling about in a cast. At least he could be fixed up. His precious Audi, half-flattened under the remains of the van, might not recover so easily. The transporter's driver and passengers, fairly well banged up themselves, were currently being patched by the second ambulance crew. Four lads dressed in workmen's overalls. The Ford Mondeo that had hit Duffy was a little farther up the road. Its very unhappy owner was talking to the police. Through the confusion of faces, he saw that of a distraught young woman looking at him. Her almond eyes were dark and full of tears. Her blonde hair tied up in a slack ponytail, with little wisps breaking loose here and there. He would remember thinking that her light summer dress was the exact same shade of red as her lips. In one hand, she was clutching a dog lead, and on the other end was the young boxer, responsible for causing the pile-up and putting him in the back of this ambulance. The woman said,
"I don't know what to say."
"Then don't say anything," Duffy replied, already half in love and content just to gaze at her. Raw opium couldn't have taken away his pain faster. She pointed towards the van passengers.
"Those men told me what happened, how you ran out and saved Brigham. You could have been killed."
"Rubbish," he replied. "I don't kill that easy."
She smiled uncertainly, not quite knowing whether to believe him.
"I'm Duffy," he said.
"Tamsin."
She motioned somewhere across the fields.
"I live just over there. We were out walking. He slipped his leash. I'm so sorry. How can I thank you for what you did?"
Duffy replied without hesitation.
"Come and visit me in hospital."
And she did. Not once, not even twice, but every day of the entire week it took until the torturers in white coats finally deemed he'd suffered enough. Then it was dinner the next night, and a whole string of dates to follow, blossoming so fast into a full-blown romance that it made Duffy's head spin and turned his blood to wine. Her name was Tamsin Gordon, and Duffy thought he'd met the love of his life. For a while, at any rate. All was bliss until his extended leave came to an end and he was called back to Afghanistan. Some women could adapt to the life, not Tamsin. Duffy found it difficult to make her share his total conviction that nothing bad would happen to him over there. As the dreaded day of his departure approached, she tried everything to persuade him to stay with her. First the tears, then the anger, then the begging, and finally the ultimatums.
It's the army or me. I can't stand the thought of waiting every day for the news that...
She couldn't even say it.
I can't say it any more. I'll be fine. It's war, Brian. People die. War is what I do, he said. It's my job. I'm good at it. Trust me.
Duffy was genuinely taken aback by the force of her emotion, even if he couldn't express that to her. But then, love was a new thing for him. For the first and only time in his life, someone actually cared. Looking back, he would think maybe he hadn't fully appreciated that fact until it was too late. The second to last time he'd seen her was the morning he left to return to the killing fields of Afghanistan. When the troop transport flew him home 3 months later, she was engaged to someone else. If a broken leg and dislocated shoulder had hurt, Duffy now discovered that a broken heart was a far more bitter ache. She'd written him a long letter in which she said she'd always love him and even invited him to her wedding. Needless to say, he had no plans to attend. Duffy did, however, go AWOL from duty in order to witness the event from the safety of the woods, a quarter of a mile from the country church where Ms. Tamsin Gordon and Mr. Tony Bell were married 2 months later. Duffy watched grimly through binoculars as the beautiful bride emerged from the church and descended the steps to the waiting limo, arm in arm with the new man in her life. That was the last time he'd laid eyes on her, certain he would never do so again. Until now. Duffy would gladly have given up the army, given up everything, to turn the clock back 4 years and not be where he was sitting now. Foxhall Cross. Chapter 10.
Now you know why we selected you, 12, Control said. You have a personal interest in this assignment that makes you just the man for the job.
Duffy felt nauseous. He had to fight the urge to tell them what he thought of their assignment and leave. He focused on his breathing until he was able to ignore the wild impulses that threatened to engulf him. He could feel the eyes on him from all around the table. At last, he felt calm enough to speak.
How did you know about me and Tamsin?
Control offered a thin smile, which was about as much warmth as Duffy would have expected from the man.
You know better than to ask that. You keep watch over all our potential recruits. From the moment we had our eyes on you, we knew everything. We were inside your life. Tamsin's too. There are no secrets in our community.
Duffy pointed towards the screen, the one he could no longer bear to look at directly.
Who did it? I know you know or we wouldn't be here.
Be patient, said Bloom, relighting his guttering pipe. You'll be briefed in just a moment.
Before we get to that, Eliza Cheatham said, watching Duffy the way a mongoose watches a cobra before tearing into its flesh. We have another picture to show you. She motioned to Control, who pressed the desk console once more. The images of Tamsin mercifully disappeared from the wall screens. They were replaced by a pair of shots of someone very different. Contrasting angles and locations, but in each image the man was similarly dressed, all in black, same as the thick mop of hair that hung over his brow. He was small and lean, in the way that Bruce Lee had been, small and lean, all work-hardened muscle and sinew, not a gram of spare padding anywhere on him. Like a tempered steel spring in human form, the kind of tough little guy who looks like he's erupting into combat even when he's standing still.
I don't know him, Duffy said. Should I?
His name is Kang Kum-sok,
Control said.
No reason you'd know him, no.
He's a hitter for the North Koreans. Not been on the scene long, but making a name for himself in certain quarters. Formerly served with their Special Operations Force before he was recruited to their equivalent of Group 15. Believed to have been personally involved with the assassination of Jang Song-thak.
That rang a bell in Duffy's mind. Uncle of the great leader, fed alive to a pack of starving dogs. Don't believe the papers, Cheatham said with a nasty smile. What happened was worse. Duffy didn't answer, still staring at the picture of the hitman. The likeness was already branded on Duffy's memory like a scar. At another touch of the console, a third image appeared. It was a grainy colour CCTV image of the inside of a plain white panel van, seen through its open rear door. The van was parked on what appeared to be a typical London street. Duffy was less interested in its location than in the two men pictured inside the van. Both were clad in black motorcycle leathers, which they were apparently in the process of removing in a hurry. The whippy little guy on the right had been snapped just as he pulled off his full-face helmet and had inadvertently turned his face to a three-quarter profile for the camera. The image definition was poor, but Duffy had no doubt this was the same Kang Kum-sok pictured in the first two photos.
"Taken a mile from the scene of the attack 3 days ago," Control said. "Our witness reports indicate that Tamsin Bell was assaulted by two men on a motorcycle, both wearing black helmets and leathers. The pillion passenger approached her on foot, making sure he got close enough to carry out his task effectively. It's clear that he called her by name at least twice, which tells us this was a targeted hit. Once the deed was done, he remounted the back seat of the bike, whereupon he and the driver made their escape to rendezvous with a waiting van, a white Volkswagen Transporter, also stolen, currently untraceable.
Which means you have no idea where these two are now, Duffy said.
No, but we're not entirely clueless, Control replied, picking up on his accusatory tone. We do have a pretty good idea that the rider of the motorcycle was this fellow on the left, Choi Sang-hak, another charmer, also in the employ of the North Korean government in much the same line of work as his friend, but tending to play second fiddle. It would be characteristic of Kang to want to carry out the acid attack personally.
It doesn't make sense. What reason do the North Koreans have to target someone like Tamsin? I doubt whether she could even point out their bloody little dictatorship on the map.
We'll come to that, Bloom said. As much as I'm sure we all sympathize with what happened to her, this meeting was called for rather more pressing reasons of national security. Our purpose, gentlemen, with a nod to Cheatham graciously returned, is to talk about the North Korean nuclear weapons program.
Chapter 11.
The DPRK have been keeping a lid on their arms program for years, Bloom said. But that hasn't stopped our agencies from knowing a good deal about what they're up to.
Cheatham took over. The Pakistan government has admitted that the DPRK had access to their nuclear arms technology in the late 90s. Obviously, we have been keeping a very watchful eye on the Koreans ever since. Duffy had the distinct impression this was all for his benefit, though he didn't know why. He listened grimly. Bloom continued.
To describe the North Korean regime as highly unpredictable would be a gross understatement. In 2003, they withdrew from the International Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, which they had already done in a half-assed way in 1993. but then suspended their withdrawal before the ink was dry on the paper. 2 years later, they admitted having developed nuclear weapons, but vowed to end their program. Then, the following year, their state